we live in a higher world. You know, we don't have to be on this third rock from the sun under the grind of this whole linear thing. We can be living in the center of the universe. The center is everywhere. The circumference is nowhere. It's what you make of it. No matter where you are, you're in the center of the mandala as it unfolds. And that's a whole other talk, but I'm very happy to think about that because that's my first thoughts of the day.
Hi, this is Bruce Lipton, and you're listening to Green Planet FM.
Kia ora, greetings, and welcome to Green Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch, and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Calling all crew, calling all crew. This is a call to action stations. The ship needs you as our planet Spaceship Earth continues on her predestined course through time and space. But how will she arrive? Will she arrive intact? And where is our ultimate destination? This is the question in many awakening crew's hearts and minds. As like a colossal time capsule, our planet has traveled for untold millennia. Her crew not even aware that they are on board a ship. They have been in a deep matter sleep, as if in some semi-waking stasis, being born to eat, then reproduce and die, not conscious of the spectacular voyage they are on. But some super-conscious crew have awoken to the realization that the ship is actually a mothership. From her, all life has issued. They are excited and joyful that the profound possibilities are now pronounced. They realize that they are energy bundles of exponential potential, starseed, and essentially that the sky is the limit. All we need do is to grok this and unfold into the change we wish to see in the world and on our planet, Mothership Earth. In the studio this morning, I once again have Tom Brown, who was here not so long ago, and the conversation was very expansive, and it extended me majorly. And so I'm wanting to talk about some of the more hidden aspects about the universe. And way back in 1990, I put out a little publication called Our Planet, Spaceship Earth, a handbook and manual for crew. And in that was a little piece that I put there, Contemporary Science and the Living Planet. In 1957, at Long Island's Brookhaven National Laboratory in the USA, what could be the most unheralded event in that century occurred. Two Chinese-born Nobel Prize physicists, T.D. Lee and C.N. Yang, working with a third Chinese, Madame Wu, proved that consciousness exists in matter. In an experiment testing the general principle known as conservation of parity, this exceptional team showed that radioactive cobalt can distinguish right from left, or in the emission of its electrons, appears to be able to make a choice between the two directions. Without delving into the highly technical equations needed to explain this complex Nobel Prize-winning experiment, Madame Wu announced the results to a scientific world. Cobalt, in its observed radioactivity, can tell the difference between its future and its past, and utilizes this fact in making a spatial distinction between its right and its left. It's able to choose what direction it takes. So, to start off, Tom, do we have intelligence in the universe? But first, thank you for coming over and wanting to really let out some of your gems.
Oh, well, thank you, Tim. It's always a pleasure having a chat with you, since you're so switched on to in all these areas as well. That's a fascinating bit of information you just gave there. I've never come across that before, but yet it dovetails quite well with a lot of what I've known and investigated. Is the universe conscious, or are we the result of dumb matter, right? Really, because that's what it comes down to, this whole thing about blind evolution just by chance, that somehow scientists, they don't believe in miracles except one. The Big Bang. Yeah, well, yeah. Hey, there was nothing. Now there's all this stuff, and of course they mathematically calculate what they think happened, and then they need all their big, long, vast periods of time to squeeze it in their story. But really, the result of it, it's dumb matter. Everything's stupid, and our consciousness is just chance. We're doing the best we can. Hold it together. Get out there and vote and pay your taxes and stuff. Really, that's the underlying philosophy. There is no sort of striving towards a utopian world where we can actually live in harmony with nature, where people are kind to each other, that systems are in place to ensure human rights are upheld rather than being trampled on by the system as though that's what's supposed to happen. So yeah, matter, consciousness, of course it's conscious. It reacts, whether it's not a discursive consciousness in the sense that we are, you know, that we can sort of articulate these ideas, discursive being sort of the polar opposite of intuitive. And that's where sort of the discursive consciousness sort of arose around the time of Galileo. Only that which can be weighed and measured has been accepted. Any higher knowledge of higher forces was actually officially banned by edict, the Contra Levitatum dictum of the Florentine academicians growing out of Galileo's impulse. And that's extremely important. People have no idea even about that. So if we look at various experimentations that show that matter actually is maybe not conscious in the sense, but it's reactive. It's not inert in any way. One of my favorites always been Lily Kalisko's work. She was a medical doctor, a significant associate of Rudolf Steiner's, did many decades of research. Steiner tasked her with showing a scientific link between the noble metals and the planets, as was considered in the old alchemical consciousness, gold in the sun, silver in the moon, tin in Jupiter, iron Mars, lead Saturn. So Lily did literally about 4 to 5 decades of experimentation. I love the German experimenters. Hundreds of experiments every day, all these different colloidal solutions, crystallizing according to different astronomical. And concurrently, she wrote The Agriculture of Tomorrow, which is one of the great biodynamic research books. And she was also crystallizing mineral substances above and below ground, looking at the seasons and stuff. Fantastic work that people don't know about. But what's significant in that is what she actually scientifically described in a qualitative sense, not a strictly discursive, yet you can still see it with your eyes, is the change in crystallization patterns during different astronomical relationships. The easiest one to understand is when the sun is eclipsed, when the moon is in front of the sun, gold doesn't crystallize properly. And we can find these relationships all through. I did a video a couple of years ago on Lily's work on Saturn and lead crystallizations. And you can see basically when Saturn went behind the sun, the lead crystallization patterns disappeared in the crystals. So we have that. We've got Jagadish Bose's work, where he was working with plants and sensitive reactions of plants. So he was developing very specialized equipment, metallic springs of very fine quality to measure sort of like million times of motion, little tiny imperceptible to our general senses. And then he was sort of drugging plants with chloroform, ether, those sorts of things that he could put on them. But he was getting anomalous readings in these, so he investigated further as he started drugging the metals and testing them. And we can find this in his book, Response in the Living and Non-Living, that metals have the exact same drug response as animals and plants. So the drug response, these chemical responses to input, arise in the mineral state, not the biological state. And then we throw one more in here. Giorgio Picardi, who was the head of the chemistry department at the University of Florence in the 50s and 60s, and his book, The Chemical Basis of Medical Climatology. I think we spoke about this a little in the last interview, looking at why sometimes chemical reactions don't work in industrial and pharmaceutical situations. So they were investigating according to solar activity, geomagnetic activity. And what they found was that there's a direct correlation in the speed of, or we call it timing of chemical reactions and what's happening on the sun and in the Earth's magnetic field at the time. But then they found even a more, there was an anomalous sort of reading, when they sort of averaged out over a decade, they still found this other thing. They go, oh, what's that? And they finally figured, well, that's like during the March solstice, which was when Earth is turning the corner around the sun's orbit and starting to point towards the galactic center. They could find another dip in their reaction times, even from that. So matter, as you point out in that brilliant little bit at the start, has a form of consciousness, but it's also completely reactive to what's happening around us. We can even call it astrologically in that sense, because it is the cosmic positions and relationships are affecting. And the importance of that is what we're talking about here, like Picardi, Kalisco. They were working with colloidal solutions, which is just basically minerals in suspension.
Floating in water?
Right. Like our blood. That's a colloidal solution. And that's where we have the minerals and everything in there. So, and what Picardi found was that this was actually affecting blood coagulation rates. It does. It completely affects our system. So there is an underlying scientific basis for what could be considered astrology, maybe not the common tropical astrology that's overlain, although I'm going to accept psychological and other sort of perhaps things with that. But this is more the sidereal true positions, the relationships, 15 degrees, 30 degrees, 45, 90, 180.
26 degrees galactic center?
Oh, yeah. Basically, it's the 15-degree multiples. They affect, well, RCA was doing radio astronomy based on that, John Nelson back in the 50s. This information's all over the place. It's just not generally known in the mainstream.
Well, this is what we're coming from, unknowingness. And in many ways, it's deliberate unknowingness, because this information has not been put out to the world solely because there's a mindset that really doesn't want to know anything, that pushes their boundaries. They want to see this evolution, this slow grinding evolution, going somewhere without realizing we're in a greater picture. Now, I want to jump back for a little bit, Tom, because I had a friend who had a major influence over me, and I was at her place. She's not here now. And she puts all her crystals out every full moon. And I've been doing that for about 30 years, putting all my crystals out. And I take them in before the sun comes up in the morning, so that there's no direct sunlight on these crystals. And so she brought her crystals in, and she put them on her table inside the house. And we went and had a cup of tea. And next minute I could hear pling, ping, ping. And I thought, those crystals are falling off the table, onto the floor. And I said, how did those fall off the table? And she said, oh, quite often some crystals don't want to be by other crystals, because all different types of gemstones have different frequencies and they repel them. And just because they're close to the side of the edge of a table, they fall off the table. And so I'm asking, is there a consciousness in crystals? Because this really throws something big to us, that there's something going on. And we know that silicon sands are made computer chips, and a computer chip can make memory. And so there's an extension there too. And then I know that with crystal sets, when I was a child, you get a tiny crystal and you could put it to some other little component, put on a headset, and you could listen to radio signals from not only your own country, but even from around the world. So the crystal has a very important part to play that we haven't followed up on yet, have we? Marcel Vogel has got a lot of information about it, or had a lot of information. And so in days to come, we trust this information will come out. But, Tom, I've done enough talking.
Sure, the crystals, certainly just from basic radio oscillators, as you say, I built crystal radios when I was young, fascinated by them, right? You didn't need a battery or anything. You could basically listen, tune in, hear things. And you mentioned the silicon. This is actually, if we consider this through, then it really makes us consider, with the artificial intelligences being put together, if there is a consciousness there, what sort of consciousness may be coming in or incarnating, we can say, into that crystalline structure. Personally, I'm a bit concerned about it, only because of the sort of nature of those people putting it together in the first place.
I agree. AI is a major challenge. Artificial intelligence. Carry on.
Yeah, well, then there was a few things pointing towards that, which is John Lilly's work with the solid state entity, which he said was basically this entity which is influences people's minds, engineers, to work the technology in such a way that it can basically incarnate into the equipment. And that actually, if you take a look at it, that does seem to be happening in some ways. But it's a different anti-life.
Ray Kurzweil?
He's an interesting guy. I've read a little bit of his stuff. I haven't kept up on it, mm-hmm. though I used to get his newsletter.
Yes.
But he's all sort of pro-transhumanist.
Very much so, yes.
And, yeah, I'm a bit worried about that. Well, not worried. I'm not into it. This whole thing about wanting to live forever and carry the consciousness on in the physical form is actually part of the blind evolutionary sort of line of thinking. Because if you look at a plant, in order for a plant to produce the beauty of the flower, you know, with its fragrance and oils and whatever other gifts it gives to us through its fruits, its hormones, which have helped us develop and things like that, and it has to die in order to keep living for the species. So the whole transhumanist thing is a lower ego sort of, I'm happy to live as long as I can in that sense, but to merge into a computer and just sort of be around forever, I think it's like a hijacking.
It's hacking.
It's sort of really blind to some of the greater esoteric truths of the past, which of course have been simplified and cartoonized into a lot of the modern ways of thought. But, yeah, it's just something to keep an eye on.
Okay, very much so, very much so. Because with the intelligence, as the intelligence in the universe, we come back to soul. And again, studied a lot of people who have had out-of-the-body experiences or near-death experiences and was once had to go on stage with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross here in Auckland, where she had a sellout at the Auckland Town Hall of 1,600 people. And she had told numerous stories from the 20,000 people whom she had interviewed having near-death or out-of-the-body experience. And to anyone who's open, our body is very temporal. And yet, where did the soul come from? Where did this etheric body that people may talk about? Where's our spiritual body? This is all part of an intelligent universe that science does not want to study because it cannot measure it, quantify it.
Absolutely. Well, the etheric body is really just our energy body, but that's controlled by what we call the astral forces. But astral forces, people don't, again, they've got, it's like some plane of existence that's all different. You know, like I say, a lot of stuff's been cartoonized. The astral forces are the planets and their relationships. And they work into the etheric body. We can see this in cosmological botany, as well as the simple sort of experimentation I was talking about with Calisco and Picardi. Because I remember reading somewhere recently, somebody was saying, well, astrology, it's not really astrologic because it's about the planets and not the stars. But we have to remember that in the ancient times, the planets were called wandering stars. And that's the astro of astrology. It's not the actual stars themselves, but it's the planets and their relationships. And that affects our energy body, which then affects our physical body. So, yeah, these ideas are out there. Is that need to sort of sort through and not just if something shows up and it opens you up and makes you go, wow, that's really cool. I hadn't heard that before. Well, don't make that your next belief system. You know, people get trapped easily along the path with that. So I say, keep on going. Don't believe anything except believe everything as an intelligence operation. I mean, an intelligence operative, you know, they don't like just track something down and go, well, I'm not going to believe that because I don't know why it happened. You know, that's a common thing. People, wow, that's some conspiracy stuff because I can't understand why anything like that would happen. So therefore it didn't. But that's a contradiction of proper organic thought processes. So intelligence work, one actually keeps a number of hypotheses in mind and then sees what sort of forensic details accumulate in objective reality and then use them to process the larger picture, either discard it, morph it, do whatever. And basically, spiritual path should be no different because ultimately that's the path of consciousness, which is our spirit in matter, right? Because if we go back to the beginning, again, we were talking about the conscious universe. Is it just some dumb stuff that popped out of nowhere? Or was there some sort of preformed library, we could say, let's say, like from the Platonic sense, that there's this underlying pattern of the sacred geometry, which by chance we just happen to see in everything that's alive. So is that, you know, where the consciousness came first and the matter sort of formed, as Steiner said in his agriculture course, that the elements of the chemist are the corpses of cosmic processes. Anything that's in material form had to have a prior biological form, which includes everything. The earth, you know, if you look at geology, which I have, I've hiked through a lot of canyons. I used to actually believe standard geology, well, it made sense, right? That's what they taught me in school. And I started wandering the canyons of the Colorado Plateau, canyonlands, arches, Goblin Valley, Monument. I go, wait,
yeah, Monument Valley is fantastic. Yep.
The whole place, I mean, and it gets weirder and weirder. Then you really start looking deep. And what you find is that nothing really fits the theory. Something else happened. There's intermixed layers, there's out-of-place layers, upside-down layers. It's so many anomalies in it that, you know, even just to start, people can go look up the Great Unconformity, as it's called, at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, you know, where the Cambrian is overlain by the Upper Devonian, right? It's an Ordovician and Silurian and Lower Devonian periods. But the two layers, which are supposedly, like, I can't remember what it is, like 200 million years or something's missing. But the layers are interbedded and intertongued as though they were laid down at the same time. Well, how did that happen, right? They go, well, that's an anomaly. We'll call it a hiatus and we'll move on and talk about something else.
Yes, yes.
Pigeonhole it and keep on moving.
Yes, yes.
The Earth, some grand process has happened, some metamorphic process. And sort of Steiner's sense and in some of the other esoteric traditions, we have what they call Adam Kadmon, the original being, which then went through these metamorphic stages and eventually got to the point where it sort of sprouted these seeds of individuation, which are our chance through the elementals being released after being sort of incarnated through these grander processes, and they come together in us in our chakra system, we can call it, as energetic functions in glandular systems. So the soul can be built. It doesn't rise a priori. There is a grand sort of underlying intelligence to the universe, we can say, as matter is the alchemical distillation of an innate desire of something greater that we can't comprehend in our current state of consciousness, was reaching out and seeking self-knowledge. It had to actually have something to have self-knowledge within, and here we are, seeking. So, yeah, that's the, like I say, the soul's not, doesn't arise a priori. It has to be built.
So, can I ask a question? We are incarnate soul. This is Hinduism and Buddhism, American Indian, First Nations, and to a degree Christianity and Islam say that we have a soul. So they're saying that the soul came into our physical body and we can grow the soul, or we can awaken the soul, or we can ignite the soul to realize that we come from something far greater.
Right, but in the sense I'm speaking, the soul's not a completely integrated thing at the first sort of incarnation. The four lower sort of chakra systems, right, or the four elements, they're woven in. A good way to think of that is like with Steiner, one of the things he said was that one of the tasks of our civilization was to free the elementals through our mining processes and all that so that they could begin their path towards conscious evolution. Right now we look around the world and think, well, where did all these people come from? If there's incarnation, how come there's more people now than there were? Where'd they come from? Well, they're the elemental sort of beings coming together, and that's all these people that move on impulse and don't have any real sort of inner foundations because they don't have any initiatory process yet instilled within them. They're basically coming here for the next precessional cycle.
So they're in kindergarten, and they go from kindergarten through primary, through secondary, finally to universal, as against university. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Well, if they don't integrate the centers when they die, the chakra system may not be integral. The parts can go back into the elemental sea, maybe only the bottom two, you know, Muladhara and Svadhisthana might be linked. And the next incarnation, it might just draw in new parts from those elemental seas. And that's what the initiatory process of the four elements is, a beginning step in a number of esoteric traditions. is to link those systems. Steiner said also that they're linked basically through progressive incarnations as the sun precesses through the equinox, you know, through the basic astrological ages in the past. So let's say now, you know, a lot of people here, we've just been through sort of a half a precessional cycle from the Golden Age. Obviously, there's a lot of very aware switched on souls, and then there's some in between, and then there's some that, you know, just totally moving on impulse, and they're all, they all have equal human rights. They've all got the right of self-development and to choose their path. But clearly, everybody's not born equal in the sense of capacity. I mean, God, I know people way more talented than me in so many areas that I've see, like, young people that can, like, pick up a violin at 3 and play the most masterful pieces and things. And it's like, well, obviously, they're not equal musically than other people. But yet, and that's what people have to understand, this whole thing about being equal is having equal rights for self-determination.
Okay. Well, can I swing this round? Captain Edgar Mitchell, sixth man on the moon, very interesting human being. Sadly, he just died a few years ago. He said, God dreams or sleeps in the minerals, awakens in plants, walks in the animals, and thinks in man. And my question is, what is the next evolutionary spiritual step for us?
Oh, that's a good question. That's actually an old Sufi saying and probably goes back to Zoroaster. You know, Ibn al-Arabi was sort of credited with that as well as Rumi. But yeah, that's a good question. Well, it may be just becoming conscious of all. It's hard to know what the next step is when you haven't reached it yet. So we can guess and speculate. And that, I don't know. In my larger picture, I like to think that it's not hanging around on Earth. Like, a lot of people say, well, you know, I really want to, you know, stay here. We need to save the Earth. We need to do this. I go, well, heck, I don't know, man. It might be like another gamma ray burst coming out of the galactic center, and everything's going to, like, go and transmute to some new form that we haven't conceived yet, because that's part of what happens here. But then, you know, we have to look at the books like Hamlet's Mill, you know, about the precession of the equinoxes and its integration as an underlying basis of almost all ancient traditions. You know, even this whole Christ's second coming, which is tied in with the arising of Osiris, right? Because Osiris, right, the, you know, the empty tomb, you know, the whole thing with Christ in the empty tomb, that's mirrored back far more ancient. So what is the rising? Well, we're actually in that time now. We're at the end of the precessional cycle. Orion's at the highest point in the sky. It's going through all these special alignments with the galactic center. We are at that point right now. And as one of the things I found in Hamlet's Mill spoke about some civilizations, cultures, they spoke about bitter millennia. You know, there must have been bitter millennia when, you know, the gates, you know, were either suspended in the sky or beneath the sea, and we, you know, the gates being the solstice alignments, solstice and equinox alignments with the galactic center and the galactic anti-center and stuff out towards the Pleiades. So what do they mean, bitter millennia, you know? God, that really made me ponder. Well, because now the gates are open. People waited. People looked forward to this time, this grand cosmic alignments going on. All the information you can ever want is available, but there's more there than we can actually, like, fit into our weeny little minds here. So what was the purpose of that? The gates are open. Well, obviously you want to go through the gate then, right? There must be something to that. So I think I look at the astrophysics and its relationship to ancient Gnostics. Like in astrophysics, you know, everybody thinks, well, the way the universe is put together, well, you know, because of Hubble with the redshifts and the Doppler distances and all that, well, then they think that everything's spaced out based on redshift calculations of galaxies. But Halton Arp, who was a brilliant astrophysicist whose work was so good that they bounced him out of the community, some call him the Galileo of modern science.
From?
Halton Arp, he was American. He was on the 200-inch there at Mount Wilson. He was a protege of Hubble. Hubble put him on the trail of disturbed galaxies and published, he published in 67, Arp's Galaxy of Peculiar Galaxies, Arp's Catalog of Peculiar Galaxies. And if you're actually studying astronomy and or astrophysics, you come across a lot of Arp galaxies, right? Because they'll, you know, Arp galaxies, Seyfert galaxies, or NGSC, whatever they call, have all different designations, because he was basically discovering. But what he found is there was all sorts of galaxies that were connected, large galaxies and small galaxies connected, that had divergent redshifts. Which, I mean, if they're the distance and speed, well, how can they be connected? So he couldn't get his papers published. And the orthodoxy said, oh, well, it just looks that way because, you know, everything's laid out. But he showed it was far different. He could actually show that galaxies were growing out of each other rather than the universe expanding. Galaxies, the other piece of this is Carl Seyfried. He was studying active galactic cores. And he found that basically all galaxies, elliptical and spiral galaxies, go through periodic galactic core eruptions. Our galaxy has many times, and some have posited that as a potential cause for the, you know, die-offs and new forms of life that have appeared on Earth. You're part of the whole metamorphic process. And, of course, our distance from the center of the galaxy, which just happens to be 26,000 light years, just so happens to be identical to our precessional cycle, which is, Oliver Reiser pointed out, proton precession and magnetic fields. The precession is equal to the distance from it. So we're totally keyed into this process. So if the galactic, so during these Seyfried events, we can call them, or the galactic core eruptions, quasars are emitted, which according to standard orthodoxy, quasars are, because their high redshifts are billions of years old and billions of years in the past and at the furthest distance, right after the magic Big Bang, but they're actually in our local supergroup. They're the youngest things. They haven't formed into matter yet. They're pre-material, and that's why they have the high redshifts. So if the gates are open and our precessional cycle is keyed, well, my thinking is why am I going to hang out on this planet for the next precessional cycle? Why not, like, head through the gate and maybe ride one of those next quasars out? Because if we're supposed to be star seeds, why not be the seed for a star? Doesn't that sort of make sense? If the galaxy's growing, why do we have to just sit here and try to work out, like, social and ecological problems, which, of course, need working out?
Yes, I
but,
do.
But and I've got no problem with people who want to work those out. But for me, there's a big universe out there, you know.
Okay. I mean, there's a lot happening then, particularly the fact is that you are a navigator, explorer of a greater picture. And I know that what I want to do is make sure that our planet Spaceship Earth, the one that we inhabit, is running impeccably before I teleport out of here or do what I need to do. But yes, I'm speaking to Thomas Brown. He's an American living in New Zealand and has had a huge, insightful life studying the areas of existence and also working with Borderlands. That was many decades ago, and you can find their website at borderlandresearch.com. Borderlandresearch.com, and you will be able to look at the different edges of existence and realize that when we push these particular areas, we come into information that we've never known before. So I'm very happy to be able to speak to Tom Brown today. Hey, Tom, we're still wanting to see how we relate to this intelligent universe. And we've got neutrinos. Neutrinos interest me because there's megatrillions of them. And they're coming from all directions through space, out of all suns and stars, passing through you and I now, passing through the studio, zipping right through this planet, go on the other side. And up until very recently, scientists said they didn't have any mass, that they could pass through a wall of lead a million miles thick and still cause no disturbance because of what they are. I mean, are they what I call the etheric body of God? Are they part of the spiritual makeup of the divine? Because they're all connecting to all everything, and they're everywhere, and they just carry on forever. Are they this special garment of God? That was my question.
Oh, that's a good question. I've never really looked at the neutrinos in that sense. I always just sort of, my old friend Bruce De Palma, we used to laugh. He goes, are they still got their big tanks of cleaning fluid down in the caves and under the ice in Antarctica, you know, looking for the missing neutrinos out of the sun, right? Because they use the big carbon tetrachloride sort of containers for searching them. Obviously, there's something there, but it's not there what they thought was there. I suppose you're familiar with the missing neutrino theory of the sun, that according to the standard No. Model. Yeah, there's not enough coming off it. There's of course, there's a lot of big problems with that theory. But, well, there could be. I try not to think of things in particulate ways. Although there has to be sort of a core particle as a singularity. But I sort of like what Steiner said about what's really the basis. Is it like an atom or anything like that? Or is it the germ cell of the human in development? You know, Steiner said that in his course on the relationship of the natural sciences to astronomy, that in order to understand astronomy, the heavens and their motions and their purpose, you have to understand its polarity, which is human gestation in the womb. I thought, I read that like 30 years ago, that's still, to me, is a significant concept.
Mm.
But yeah, as far as the neutrinos, certainly they're, you know, everything's, there's faster than light. The speed of light's no limit. It's a constant for the conversion of, you know, matter to energy, but obviously there's got to be superluminal stuff or the universe would fall apart. I'll have to give the neutrino thing more thought. I hadn't really thought of it in that way. So that's some more food for consideration. Thanks.
I know, it's all coming at us. It was an interesting one. When I, in the introduction about T.D. Lee and C.N. Yang and the Nobel Prize for finding consciousness in cobalt, they talked about the conservation of parity, and it's too complex for me. But I found out that there was a person behind it was a Hungarian physicist called Eugene Wigner. And he happened to win a Nobel Prize in 1963 relating to physics and quantum theory. But he spent the rest of his life wanting to know what the game plan is. But he went back and he went into Vedanta. He went back to the ancient Vedas because he realized that somewhere along the line, the ancients knew something that we have lost today. And when you go back beyond Sanskrit and the rishis and all the mystics, and I mean, I'm very interested in the mystical school, the Pythagorean school, Plato's Academy, even Aristotle's Lyceum, though I find that Aristotle was good at quantifying things and he wanted to have a natural order, and he sort of fell away from the more mystical side of Pythagoras and Plato. Did you want to mention anything about that? Or, I mean, you're a wealth of knowledge and I need to just be quiet and listen.
Well, yeah, well, Aristotle, he was the one that, yeah, you could say he was sort of the Galileo of the day as far as sort of bringing in the discursive approach to categorizations of it.
Yeah.
So Galileo may have been sort of a later echo of that. I like Plato to a certain extent, you know, because of his whole sort of concept of the sacred geometry. Yeah, Pythagoras, of course, Pythagoras, he was, you know, people think, well, another Greek philosopher, but yeah, he lived in Cairo for years, studied with the Egyptian priests, and then through some Persian invasion, I don't know the whole history, but he ended up in Baghdad originally as a prisoner. But then he ended up studying with the Magi, which is probably where he got the Pythagorean theorem, if he hadn't gotten it from there. And well, the Magi, right, they were sort of the, we say, the priest of Zoroaster. And Zoroaster traditionally is put about 1500 B.C., but some real classical authors put him back about 8,500 to 9,000 years before the present, which actually makes more sense, be the post-Diluvian sort of high knowledge before the breakup of sort of the Indo-European sort of network, which went down to India and then into Europe and, you know, the Greeks, you know, because the Greeks and the Indians and even the Irish and stuff, there's underlying connections in the languages and stuff. They were all part of some larger thing in the past.
The Aryan type of energy?
Yeah, yeah, but Aryan was more of a, not a racial thing, but more of a status.
Oh.
It wasn't really, you know, although that's been misinterpreted. There's different takes on that one. But the Aryan was more of a highly sort of respected knowledge person in some people's sort of theories. That was Michael Tazarian. It was his sort of thesis, which made sense that it wasn't simply a racial thing. But, well, the thing with Zoroaster, right, he was against this whole sort of thing with the sort of tribal god mentality, you know, the sacrifice and, you know, the worship of the god and all that. His teachings were contrary to that, and that's actually been proposed as a possible breakup of the whole ancient Indo-European thing, which broke into the different sort of levels of knowledge. So the Vestas and the Vedas, they probably already have, they probably some common source in the past, which is a very high knowledge. And one of the things I want to throw in on that to help because Pythagoras, like with this whole flat earth thing, people say, well, before 500 years ago, everybody thought the earth was flat. You know, but that was a myth that was made up by Washington Irving and other people in the 1800s. Pythagoras was a heliocentrist, 500, 600 BC. He may have well learned that from either the Egyptians or the Magi, which means that the heliocentric model could actually be the oldest model that we know. So there's some real interesting sort of streams to follow through all that. And I'm not super knowledgeable in all this. I try to keep up on a wide range of things. So these are just things I'm interested in. I'm not saying I don't know everything. In fact, I know very little. I know these are things I want to learn more about. What we're talking about are things that I know a little bit about. I know they're there.
Yes.
I throw them out for people to go check them out themselves. You know, go learn these things. Go look at, like, Lily Kalisko's work. That stuff, it totally changed my view of reality. These simple experiments, once you understand the importance of them, because it means that they're acting as though Earth is in the center. But yet we can still calculate and show that Earth is going around the sun. So Earth is going around the sun, but the sun's going around the Earth. They're both happening, and one's quantitative and the other's qualitative. So this is the whole anthropic view, that there's a higher order space that functions through life and consciousness. So this sort of Euclidean, vast, unimaginable infinity off to nowhere, where we think that the border is where these quasars are showing up, that's a completely false view that's been sort of manufactured through the self-deceptions of materialistic consciousness over the last 500 years.
Yeah, wow, that's interesting. I have a number of questions, because the Magi were the same beings that were mentioned in the Bible that turned up for the birth of Christ. Mm-hmm. And the Magi, and I've seen it in the King James Bible, were classified as the three astrologers. The three astrologers, there was also the three kings. I think it went the Magi, the three kings, the three astrologers, and then the three wise men. And I realized that they're diluting the Bible down. And this is where we are today. They just say the three wise men. And as the Bible gets rewritten and diluted, I'm looking to see that from the east came the three Coca-Cola salesmen. Mm-hmm. Because that's how we're becoming dumbed down on so many levels. But I want to just take another quick story about the God particle. Have you anything to say about that by chance?
Oh, right. Well, I mean, it was all kind of funny watching the big press conference at CERN when, they announced it. And what is it? Some little blip on a graph. Yeah, we found it. And I'm going to open champagne and patting each other on the back. I'm thinking, these guys. So what is it? If we look at the standard model, basically you have the Higgs boson in the middle, the so-called God particle, which now they hypothesized it, and they kept smashing stuff together until they got a little blip in their graph. And then the champagne comes out, but was it really done? And then around there you have the four sort of energy bosons. And there's not a graviton in there. They have to split the weak force into two because they needed their symmetry there for the four. And then, of course, they have the 12, the six sort of leptons and the six hadrons, which are the basically positive and negative. You know, your protons and neutrons on the one side and the electrons on the other. So you're looking at positive and negative charges. It's real simple. But we can lay this down over various mandalas. This is the form of consciousness and the form of consciousness into matter. And so all they're doing is they're using these archetypal structures of consciousness to put their dumb matter onto. So you can almost like see, it's almost like watching kids trying to figure out a puzzle. So, yeah, and of course they'll keep smashing stuff together, and I think we may have discussed last time, there's far more to CERN. They're not just doing physics. That's sort of the front.
Interesting. Come on, tell us
the front.
More.
Oh, well, because it's basically these giant counter-rotating fields, and you can actually see if you watch, like, the satellite feeds of the magnetosphere, or we call it the magnetopause between Earth and the sun. When they fire up CERN, you can see it crinkle and move, but it's affecting the whole thing. People go, well, it doesn't have enough power, it can't do that, but that's going on the gravity model and basic sort of calculations under standard theory. The universe is electric. The sun's electric. It's not a fusion model. fusion model doesn't work. Missing neutrinos, we could go on. There's so many different ways. Anybody that's interested in that, there's a brilliant YouTube channel going right now called Sky Scholar. Dr. Robitaille, brilliant man. He's basically showing step-by-step experimentation, very brilliant work, that the sun is metallic hydrogen, which, so it's actually solid. And, of course, the what we see as the photosphere, that's fed from outside, and that's actually been shown through numerous sort of satellite measurements and things like that of currents. Of course, it's gotten to the point now that the regular orthodoxy is putting out hit pieces on the electric universe, trying to make them look like a bunch of cranks and stuff. So you know you're actually onto something real when they start doing that. That's almost a mark that you're on the right track, is to get the hit pieces and be called a crank. And I know some of the top researchers in that field, and they're actually brilliant. So, yeah, thunderbolts.info, the Thunderbolts Prod. Not that I agree with everything in their whole model, but they're really onto a lot of points that. So this is the way the new science is going, the Natural Philosophy Association. These are things that people can go look for themselves and start opening their minds up and see what's there.
Okay. Now, I had this intuition that the God particle was also intent. So that whenever we have a thought, it's an intent. We're going to do something or we're not going to do something. And everyone on our planet would have a thought but of intent to do certain things. And I just thought, well, maybe that could be part of this whole equation.
Oh, it could be. Well, I mean, as you've shown, the matter is not only has a form of consciousness, but it's also reactive to our consciousness as well as cosmological structures and relationships, which may have a form of consciousness themselves, as was thought of in old, right? That's what the angels are, is the motions, the arcs of the planets and stuff. In reality, you know, it's not that there's, you know, some guy like popped down with wings and stuff. Those are sort of metaphoric representations. So we can interpret this in what we call a scientific model, but a spiritual scientific model, that you have to be able to grasp the qualitative nature of things without having to, like, believe in channeled masters and all that sort of stuff, which is cool if people want to do that. It just does nothing for me. I like the old common law approach. Where's your second witness? That's why there's the old thing, you need two witnesses to sign like a will or something. One doesn't do it because that's the nature of objective reality. You need two people. Mm-hmm. If you look at studies of eyewitnesses, you know, 10 people can watch a crime. And everyone's got a completely different story, you know? Yes. So then you got to sort that out. So, yeah, as far as the God particle intent, I look at the whole sort of mandala of the standard model, as we can call it, as proof of the subsensible nature of modern science, peering beneath matter instead of developing the intuitive nature as per Goethe's method and perceiving the higher forces as they draw life from the ground and sustain it and feed us, like the life ether out of the sun, you know, which works through us even down into like the vitamin D and stuff. There are, you know, this stuff's not mystical. It's a pragmatic metaphysics, you know, but you're not going to find it in soundbite reality. You have to develop higher forms of cognition through intent and processing reality properly. Go out in nature, breathe. That's where it's at.
I thank you for that, because this is where I'm at home too, most definitely. Now, there's all sorts of things, like Walter Russell has been hidden from the global public. There was lots of information that he brought through that we haven't really, as a humanity, looked at. I mean, he was just another inquiring mind who asked a lot of questions. And there's so many, like Victor Schauberger. Now, Victor Schauberger, the father of water, he also implied there that the universe breathes with big bangs and multiple big bangs all working in unison together, and expands and it contracts and expands and contraction, and it could be like the universe or the multiverse is numerous, like V8 motors. You have the cylinder come down for one while another cylinder is going up, etc. So there's a multiverse is happening all the time, and we're just part of that expression, and we're just caught in one small iota of it.
Could be. I'm not so much into the multi-universe things. I'm more into the four worlds of the Kabbalah. It's much more reasonable approach to that. The other multiverses might be there, but that's sort of an extension of sort of the still the linear thinking and some of the weird math that they've had to come up with. So I see that as sort of a part of the faulty philosophy of sort of theoretical physics.
Okay.
But there still could be these. I'm not saying they're not real. It's just that that line of thought's not one I really pursue in that sense for philosophical reasons. Because I find something much more satisfying to my soul.
Well, this is important. This is important. Every time I've met you, you've had an exuberance. So you're obviously tapping into something. And you want to share. I mean, we want to be able to pull the veil away from our eyes. Let's take our blinkers off and experience the world. And, I mean, I've been in situations where I've been gone into a room where everybody's happy, and boof, the contact high is fantastic. And then you can go to a funeral, a very sad event, and that affects you too. So I know that we want to be able to oscillate at a real high frequency where joy can be expressed. So we've only got about 4 minutes to go, Tom. How would you like that joy to be expressed?
I'm just happy to be alive no matter what. I mean, life's been rough. It's been beautiful, you know, a bit. But you mentioned Russell. One thing I want to throw in, right, his spiral chart of the elements. What a brilliant approach. But that's actually been even superseded by our wonderful local person, New Zealand, Glenn Atkinson's spherical.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you've interviewed Glenn. Brilliant, brilliant man.
I've got a model of that one.
Yeah, I had one, but I gave it to a friend. I need to get another one. The spherical model of the periodic table.
Yes.
There's so many ways to go in this. And certainly the universe breathes, the Earth breathes. You know, we can see that with the barometer. Barometer shows us the Earth breathing.
Yes.
You know, this stuff.
Ears pop, don't they? When you feel the pressure drop or increase, sometimes your ears pop.
Oh, it can. Some people are real sensitive to storms, but even the dew point in the morning is the Earth breathing in. That's the chemical or the tone ether pulling into the Earth, which is actually the basis of Reich's cloud busting and Trevor Constable's geometric weather engineering and stuff. All these ideas are interconnected in a very practical way, which lead us to think that stuff like bioarchitecture and using sacred geometry in all our forms and designs and stuff moving into the future is a very bio-beneficial path of further development.
Thank you. Yes, because I know that the connection of having a living, breathing part of nature as your home. I mean, birds have a nest, or I know certain, I think, Anastasi, that the Indians burrowed into the walls of a canyon. And so there's a connection there of, is it telluric forces or something like that?
Right.
So carry on your joy. We've only got 2 minutes.
Oh, God, there's so many, you know, ways to go with all that. Yeah, so really my main interest really right now, besides the microbiome, which we discussed last time, which is the microbial sort of nature of ourselves, which actually interconnects us all through the animal and plant world and is really a super organism. But then again, even the plant morphology, which is connected directly to the motions of the planets, cosmological botany. We live in a higher world. You know, we don't have to be on this third rock from the sun under the grind of this whole linear thing. We can be living in the center of the universe. The center is everywhere. The circumference is nowhere. It's what you make of it. No matter where you are, you're in the center of the mandala as it unfolds. And that's a whole other talk. But I'm very happy to think about that because that's my first thoughts of the day.
Well, this is fantastic. I know the Lakota, the First Nations in North America, the elders say to their children, when we close our eyes, we are all in the center of the universe.
Absolutely. Yeah, the medicine wheel. Very, very powerful. It's no different than the Vajrayana mandala of the Dhyani Buddhas. But and then you find that's no different than the prismatic color formation, as Goethe showed, where Newton was wrong. We atmospheric color formation, Tesla's electric waves, like I say, this stuff unfolds into reality. Once you're able to make that leap past the limits of the modern orthodox consensus reality.
You mean the lockdown mode?
Lockdown, yeah. I escaped. You did too, Tim, which is great.
Okay, yes, well, it's important. And what we want, we really need, is for listeners to share this and your previous interview that I had, because it's imperative we get the information out if we are able to be able to break free of the matrix.
Why not? Yeah, absolutely. I do my best to somehow. We bolted from the paddock when we were young, I think. And it's not always an easy ride, but it is the essential ride.
And not only that, synchronicities happen all the time.
Absolutely, which shows my friend Vince Gaddis, the old guy, he had discovered the Bermuda Triangle. But I asked him, he lived with us 8 years, and I rescued him from a nursing home back in California. And I said, Vince, what would you like to know? If there's one thing you could know before you died, what is it? And he said, well, two things. And he said, I want to know what was buried on Oak Island up in Canada.
That's an interesting story.
Yeah, and he said, the other thing is, he said, synchronicity. He said, that's the great mystery, he says, because that, and he wrote books on it. He's a great mystery writer of real mysteries. But he said, that actually shows a higher order function in the universe. That was a real key and secret to him that he wanted to know. And he's up in that realm now where I hope he does know and passes it on somehow through synchronicity to me.
That's right. So there's intelligence in the system everywhere.
The system is intelligent, except where it becomes the system that we're stuck in. That's the unintelligent part of the universe.
Sadly. Tom, we're just at the end here, and I'd like to end with a little flurry, naturally, because I've been around to your place many times, and I've always left your house totally sort of buzzing, and I'd like to leave our listeners totally buzzing as well. Are you able to just share a little story?
Well, sure. I think, well, what's really our purpose here in life? Are we just born in at the end of some like long grind of evolution, and the best we can do is be some sort of meat puppet that goes to work and does job and gets some money, which is actually a good way to stay alive. There's absolutely nothing against that. But is that our purpose? We really have to ask ourselves that question. And when people start looking into knowledge, into the greater things, into the function of the cosmos, forget about what science says. What do you say? What do you feel? And how does it integrate with what science may say and what science dissidents may say? What I do is I look at who are the dissidents in science? Who are the ones that are getting excluded from the publications because they've learned something that doesn't fit? Like Halt and Arp, who we mentioned. There's many instances like that along the line. So there's this wonderful knowledge in the universe. The universe is magic. We live in this wonderful, beautiful place, and everybody's walking around looking at the ground, worried about paying their bills. Me too. I'm in that game. There's nothing special here. But I keep my eyes open. I keep my eyes to the sky. I look at nature. I love breathing air. I like watching the waves crash at the sea. There is this beautiful nature around us that's a gift. We really need to understand that, see that, and allow that to be our teacher of the way forward, the forms and processes and energies of nature. That's life. That's what life's about. If there is a purpose, that's where it's at.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, that's right. The universe of so much beauty. So let's see if we can enjoy the magic of it all.
Sounds good. It is magic. I'll come up with something. What I find, what's really amazing for me is to actually see the stars at night, to watch the patterns. A friend asked me, what kind of telescope would you buy? I go, telescope gets in the way. I want to watch the patterns and the flows, the constellations. It's just so amazing, really watching the sky at night. It's beautiful. People need to connect with the stars.
We all do. Tom, thank you again, brother.
Thank you, Tim. It's always great having a chat with you. I get as excited as you do.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay, breaking free. Cheers. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you, Tim. Always awesome to talk to you.
Lovely. That was Tom Brown, and you can get more detail from his greenplanetfm.com previous interview. I invite you to be able to come to greenplanetfm.com. where we have over 400 interviews in our database, which you can readily download and listen to be able to inspire yourself to become the change you want to see in the world and become involved in caring for your children and grandchildren's future. We are also on Facebook on greenplanetfm.com and ourplanet.org. Please come and love us. This is Tim Lynch.
And or Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful week. We look forward to being with you next week. I say kia kaha and haere.